You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
It's all about getting a dollar. Don't trust nobody. Keep your eyes open. Don't play with nobody. Focus on what you're supposed to get out of it. This shit is dangerous. It'll take you down. What's the difference between the rap game and the crack game?
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This episode, we celebrate 20 years of Nas's classic debut, Illmatic, by bringing you a live conversation with him from this year's South by Southwest Music Festival in Austin, Texas. I was joined at the Rap Genius Ranch by RG's Nicole Otero. We sat down with Nasty Nas and asked him about lyrics from his classic record. Many of the questions were from Rap Genius users, and you'll hear their usernames shouted out throughout the interview. In addition, there's a Q&A section at the end with the audience, and one of the people asking questions is noted A&R exec Kiambo Hip Hop Joshua, so keep an ear out for that. A special note about this show. Because it was recorded in front of a live audience, there is a little bit of background noise, and my and Nicole's voices may be slightly lower than Nas's. So sit back, relax, and get ready for a guided tour through the most important hip-hop album of all time from the man behind it. If you want to see Nas's answers in the context of his lyrics, make sure to check out his verified Rap Genius account at rapgenius.com/Nas. And with no further ado, here he is.
So the first question we just wanted to ask is, like, why the Wild Style sample right on the Genesis? Like, what did that have to do with your Genesis and hip hop?
That was the first movie. That was the first hip-hop movie, I think, yeah. So when I saw it as a kid, I always had it in my head. Like, there was a crew in there called Double Trouble, and they had these routines back and forth, and it was real dope. So when I started working on the album, it just hit me. It just felt like, go there. You know what I mean? Go there. I didn't even have to think about it. It was like, this has to start with something from Wild Style. Kind of to let you know how much of a fan of this culture I am. You know, so before you hear the album, let's go here. You know, I guess it was 10 years or something after Wild Style was out, something like that. So it wasn't really that long ago, but it seemed like so long ago that movie was out. So boom, put it on the album.
Yeah, and that Double Trouble routine you recreated later with AZ.
Yeah. So Sprite comes.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about, this comes from our user One Love.
Appropriately
enough, from a New York State of Mind. You've talked about the never sleep because sleep is the cousin of death line, the history of that. But there's this line right after it that's just incredibly poetic and in some ways equally famous. Beyond the walls of intelligence, life is defined. And I was hoping you could break that down for us.
We are not smart enough to figure out life. I feel like life is tests, a bunch of tests. And we get a lot of answers right, but we're not going to figure it all out, because if we figure it all out, there's no reason to be here. So all the way to the end, you know what I mean? So we can try as much as we want, and we can come up with a good routine to live by that can get us through and be happy with that routine in life. But you know, so many people are just trying to figure out what it's all about, whether it's through Christianity, church, and those people believe in that, or Islam, and, you know, Muslims believe in another way. But I feel like we ought to go, if you really want to understand it, it's beyond, it's not possible. I get, you know. Sometimes I think too much.
Me too. It never stops, right?
It doesn't stop, man.
Well, this is an easier question, I think. Yeah. So on Life's a Bitch, but also on the whole album, AZ's the only feature. Was that a conscious decision? How did it come about? Why only him? Why him?
I guess like when I met him, you know, he was up and coming, and I was all about what's new, you know. So I saw him, he was up and coming, and I think we had a lot in common, just like growing up. We knew, we had a mutual friend, passed away, rest in peace, Yammy, who was the guy who came to me and said, you got to meet this kid from Brooklyn. Yammy was known all over New York. Yammy be in the Bronx. He'd be in Brownsville. He'd be in Astoria Projects. He was like that. So a lot of people knew him. So he knew AZ from Brooklyn. And he kept telling me, yo, you guys remind me of each other in a way I think it can be big. Hey, this is before I even had an album out. You know, he's like, this could be big. So when I did meet him and we go back and forth, you know, I liked what he was doing the most. Yeah. And she's nice. She's like incredible. And once we did the song, once we went through a few verses, he had a whole bunch of rhymes. And I knew when I heard the right one, I'd say, yeah, that's the one. And he said that rhyme, and I was like, damn, it's crazy.
Well, I had seen an interview where he actually said that, like, it took him a long time to feel like that wasn't a bad verse.
Oh, wow.
It was, like, later that he felt like, while it was happening, he was like, I did not feel like that was a good verse, which, like, you know, yeah. For me, I remember hearing that the first time and thinking it was incredible lyrically. But he said it was, like, later after he realized the magnitude of the album that it was like, okay, maybe that was better than I initially thought.
A lot of people that's really good at something, they do that, you know?
So, On the World Is Yours, you have the line about dwelling in the rotten apple. You get tackled or caught by the devil's lasso. And so much of the album is looking at Queensbridge, right? And it's about Queensbridge. It's on the cover. The sides of the album are named after, you know, different parts of Queensbridge.
Right.
When you reference New York City here, what was your view of New York City at the time? Because you talk about New York as a whole here with the rotten apple. Like, was when you thought of New York City, did you think of, like, outside Queensbridge, or was it entirely based on your experience in Queensbridge?
When you
talk about New York, or the album as a whole, the Rotten Apple, were you thinking about Queensbridge or about
no,
the city?
No, New York. Yeah, the whole city. The Big Apple, you know, so it's the Rotten Apple, too. You know, it's like we got all kinds of different ways of talking about the Big Apple, you know. So, yeah, the Rotten Apple, because shit, it was, a lot of shit was like, it was grimy. There's a lot of griminess. So, you know, you see that. You live around it. And you just, you know, say stuff like that.
Yeah, on the same song, you say, born alone, die alone, improve, keep my crown of throne, empty by sound alone, cave inside 1,000 miles from home. So we were just wondering about this lyric, both as it relates to you as, like, a person, because it feels like a very personal line, but also literally at the time, considering, like, other crews that were out, Tribe, De La Soul, like, how did you feel just sort of also being kind of alone compared to, like, rolling with the whole crew and being associated with people?
Well, I knew that was the new thing. I knew I was on the new thing. It was a time in rap music for solo artists to really, you know, take their position. Before that, it was everybody was a group. You had a few solo acts, of course, but it was equal on each side, you know. Solo acts, then a bunch of groups. And I saw it changing. I saw it changing to being more focused on the one guy, like a Rakim or Kool G Rap, or when Ice Cube left N.W.A. and became solo. I saw Busta leaving Leaders of the New School. I saw it becoming like people wanting to, they liked the introduction of the crew, like, but then they, because afterwards, there were still groups. Wu-Tang came, and then they like, they sprouted out and started doing solo projects. But at first it was a group. So groups was still cool, but I knew that one solo, it was time we'd have at least 10 songs from that one guy that you like in that group. But and plus, it's more money for me if I'm solo, really. Like, I saw groups, like, fighting. I saw groups, like, mad because one got more attention than the other. And then it'd be the end of a great group because inside fighting, you know, some of the greatest bands and rap groups broke up because of whatever differences. And a lot of it had to do with probably finances. So I saw that quick. Like, I don't need the drama. Like, we might start something big and then be fighting two albums down, and now the whole dream is messed up because of, nah, I just went dolo.
Well, along those lines, did you ever feel like going dolo had its, like, is there something you feel like you miss not having that crew around you?
There's times like I need five of me's. There's times I felt like that, but hey, you know, my bed, sleeping in. I made my bed.
So on that same tune, this comes from our user Shine On and Bleak. So you have the line about the beach making falling asleep. I keep falling, but never falling 6 feet deep. So what exactly are you saying here? You obviously have another very famous line about sleep. Is this related to that at all?
The beats make me fall asleep. I keep falling. I never. It's like, you know, a dream state. The rap beats put me in a dream state, and I'm falling deeper in the dream state. And then I begin writing in that dream state. I'm in this whole world of my own. I keep falling, but never falling 6 feet deep. It's kind of like, you know, I said sleep because of that. Like, falling into the sleep here because of the beat is rocking me to sleep, but in a good sleep.
We actually wanted to ask, like, because this was in 92 before the album, so earlier than the album, but at what point did you go from Kid Wade to Nasty Nas, and why?
I should have never mentioned Kid Wade.
like
that shit follows me around. Like again, like 83 is breakdance time. 84, 85, you know? So, again, another movie, hip-hop movie, I heard of Beat Street. Some of y'all in the group New York City Breakers. You had the Rocksteady Crew versus the New York City Breakers. And I started to pick out the names and know who's who. Crazy Legs and Mr. Wiggles, Mr. Wave. Mr. Wave was ill. He's like, because everybody wanted to be the best pop locker, right? But his name is Mr. Wave. That means he nails it. And then when he did his thing in the movie, he kills it. So I was like, I'm Kid Wave. Now I could not pop like this dude at all. But in my head, you know, that's what he was a hero. And then one day I saw him on my block. He was on my block, this dude from NYC Breakers, to battle this other dude. I'm like, this dude do movies. He don't have to do this shit. But he's still in my projects. And I'm like, well, Mom, that's Mr. Wave. She's like, I don't care who. Like, I'm like, that's Mr. Wave. I got to stay outside. It's like, you know, it was after school. I was a kid, and it's like, I couldn't even watch the battle. I missed that battle. So that made him more of a legend than me, though. So I was like, Kid Wave. Yeah.
When did you make the transition,
though? It wasn't a transition. I had a lot of nicknames back then. So it wasn't like that was my name. Niggas ain't see me and say, yo, what up, Kid Wade? It was just in my breakdancing crew when we was kids. Yeah. So that followed me everywhere, the Kid Wade thing. But Nasty Nas comes from, first I was Rapper Nas, because it was this kid, this dude named Rapper Ron. And Rapper Ron was dope. So he just walked by and you tell him to say a rhyme and he just beat on the building inside the lobby or on the benches and he just freestyle about whatever you wearing, Rapper Ron, you know. But so I was like, I like that, I'm Rapper Nas. So everybody be like, yo, this dude is nice, or this dude is nasty, this dude is nice, or he's nasty. Say that, like, this dude, everybody starts saying, this kid is nice, that kid is nice. But nasty meant like, he's on another, you know? So I was like, Nasty. Yeah, I ain't rapping Nas now. It's like, so it went from rapping Nas to Nasty Nas. And I used to have dreads. So I'll give you some more. This kid, DJ Hot Day, he had a lot of jokes back then, and he used to be like, he used to see me, Nasty Nas with the nasty dreads. So he was the first one to call me, even though I had named myself that on the low. He called me that without knowing, just fucking with me. Yeah.
Nice. You have that great line about X-Clan hair with dreads at the top of my
face. Yeah. So, yeah, for sure.
So on Halftime, you have that line about go to hell with a foul cop who shot Garcia. And so getting serious for a second, I was wondering if that was, if you could tell us a little bit about that.
It was a recent death in, I think, Washington Heights. And, this cat Garcia, can't remember his last name. He got killed around the time I was writing that song. So I almost dedicated a verse to that issue, but I managed to just keep it in there, just slip it in there really quick. Yeah, it was an incident that happened in, if I'm not mistaken, Washington Heights, New York. Cop killed a kid, a teenager.
Moving on to memory lane, this comes from a user named Isaiah G. He said, so obviously you start saying, I rap for listeners, bluntheads, by ladies and prisoners, Hennessy boarders and old school. What do you rap for? Do you rap for the same people today? Who do you rap for today?
Yeah, same people. I said I rap for listeners. That was the first line. I rap for listeners, bluntheads, still rap for bluntheads, fly ladies, of course.
prisoners,
of course. Word. That's
On that same tune, obviously you're remembering, you're looking back at your neighborhood, and you talk about that on that song. You talk about Fat Cat. You talk about Supreme Team. About Hustlers, Queens Hustlers, from when you were growing up. And so back when you were growing up, back when you were writing that stuff, how did you view people like Cream, people like Fat Cat?
At that point, I didn't know them. I didn't know them. I speak about it the way they were spoken about in the street. You know, it was like Fat Cat. I knew somebody that was related to Fat Cat. I saw their life change because he was rich. I saw them go from rags to riches just because they were related to him. Supreme Team, of course, that name was just huge, you know. It was a rap song. What's the guy's? Malcolm McLaren, I think. He might have made it. The world famous Supreme Team show. So you already had heard of that. So now somebody in Queens, in Jamaica, Queens had this name, and you know Supreme comes from the 5%, 5%ers. So you know there was a seriousness to it. And you'd hear about them all the time. All these guys that were in that crew. And you know it was serious. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you said his name, you know, comes from 5% stuff, and there's obviously a lot of 5% stuff scattered throughout the album.
Yeah. It's interesting, man. I mean I got to meet Supreme later. And in New York City mainly, you know, what the 5% Nation was something positive for the kids in the street. And even the mayor at that time was on the cover of the newspaper with the father, Clarence, 13X, leader, father of 5% Nation. They were on the newspaper together because of the work he was doing with the youth. He was doing more than the cops could do, and he was saving lives. So he didn't look down on a street cat. Whereas in Nation of Islam, you can't play games, you can't drink, you can't smoke weed, you're supposed to be right and exact 100%. So this right here, he kind of allowed people to be them, but they had to have knowledge. They had to gain knowledge every day. And that was something more that acceptable by the young, you know, so that became just the words from, you know, the lessons became words in the street. Like, you say word. When you say word to somebody, you said, it's a part of saying word is bond. My word is bond. you cut it short. Word, it comes, word is bond, a word. You know, a lot of phrases come from peace. When I see peace, peace, you know what I mean? Peace out. That all comes really from so many different words coming. And then rappers was using those words, and those words became international slang words. The whole world started talking like that, you know? So it was already in me. When I was a kid, older God pulled me to the side and told me, not y'all, not the rest of y'all, just you. And he pulled me to the side and he gave me, so I got to give you something. And he gave me some lessons. And he's like, I want you to go over this and talk to me tomorrow about it. So everyone grew up. If you grew up, if you was an 80s baby, you grew up with that in your life at some point.
Okay, so on One Love, you know, we just picked the first line, but you know, what a kid, I know she interrupted you a bit, but really the question comes from this idea that you're writing, it's almost as if you're writing to someone in jail. Are you writing to someone specific, or across the different verses, or is it just this idea that's kind of prevalent all over Illmatic, that you're writing to people that you knew who had gone away?
Yeah, it's like a combination of people, so it wouldn't be that personal. So the names are real. Dudes I shout out at the end, all that's real. And I just take different situations from them and make it one story rather than, you know, five verses about all of them. You know, I just made it one song.
So on the same song, a couple different users actually asked us about this, two of them, Thomas Howard and Aerobi 1992. You say, then I rose, wiped your blood to ash from my clothes, then froze to blow the herb smoke through my nose, and told my little man, I'm a ghost, I froze.
It's funny, one of my mans asked me that when it was still just, it wasn't even done, but we should ride around and listen to the album. I was working on it. And he said, what the fuck did you say? I'm a ghost, I'm ghost, I bros.
Yeah, I
said, you know, ghost means I'm out.
Yeah.
We should say, instead of leave, let's breeze. In my neighborhood, I don't know if everybody else should say it, but yo, let's breeze. Yo, I'm breezing. Y'all bros. So, yeah, so that's right. So I wasn't thinking about, I thought everybody would know. I'm like.
So it's I'm a bros.
No, I'm ghost. Okay. Not I'm a ghost. I'm ghost, I bros. So it means I left. I breezed. But breezed, yes. You know what I'm saying? Yes. So, like.
Set the record straight.
Story. So One Time for Your Mind, which is maybe my personal favorite on the record. You have the line, my brain is incarcerated. And over again, Illmatic talks about jail, and it talks about Queensbridge, and how in some ways they might not be all that different. When you were writing Illmatic, were you thinking about the relationship between jail and your project?
Yes, because it was a possibility every day you'd be there. You'd be one day hanging out, the next day locked up, whether you're guilty or not. So if you're standing next to your boys, you might be doing nothing, but your boys might be doing something. Or they might have just did something that they're not telling you about. And now I hear the cop car come with that victim in the back seat pointing in your direction. Or a cop thinks he's recognized you as making a sale. Now he arrests you. Now it's you against him in the court for a direct sale. And it could have not been you. You probably had the same jacket your man had on that just made the sale and he left. And so any day, it could be your day if you're innocent. You know what I'm saying? So if those are the conditions, it wasn't my intentions to write about jail like that. I didn't want to write about jail. I didn't want to just like, I'm going to write about jail. It was my vocabulary. It was my conversation. It was the conversations around me. So that's why it's always there. Yeah.
So unrepresented.
Which is sad. Some sad shit.
I think that like that was, you couldn't escape it even though you were trying not to have that be with us.
No, it's like, there's 46,000 teens arrested in New York City alone every year. That's more than any place in the nation. Between the ages of 16 and 17, 46,000, most black and Latino. So, you know, you see what I was dealing with.
Okay, so kind of unrepresent, you say somehow the Rat Gang reminds you of the Crack Gang. And we chose this line because now this sort of metaphor is commonplace, but I feel like when you were writing it, it was early on. So considering your immediate surroundings and watching everything that you were seeing at the time, like, what did that literally mean for you? What were the similarities between the two?
It's all about getting a dollar. Don't trust nobody. Keep your eyes open. Don't play with nobody. Focus on what you're supposed to get out of it. This shit is dangerous. It'll take you down. What's the difference between the Rap Game and the Crack Game? You know what I mean? So, and that was before, like, I started seeing more entertainers get arrested after they got on. You know, I got arrested again after I get on. I'm like, how do I get caught up after I'm on? You know, so it was like, you know, if you're riding a nice car, you know what I mean? You know what that is. In a certain neighborhood, is, you know, you looked at like, you know, you can get handled. You can get handled by people that don't like you or cops, whatever. It's the same thing.
One of the best things on Represent, one of my favorite moments, is you mark time by what you were listening to right before the BDB conflict with MC Shan. And that got me thinking, obviously being from Queensbridge, seeing the previous generation of rappers from Queensbridge, how were the Bridge Wars experienced by people who were actually in Queensbridge? Because you referenced the Bridge Wars on that song.
It was different levels. Like, the older than me, they had known Roxanne Shanté really well. They known Marley Marl really well. They were rappers from the older guard. They were from the Afrika Bambaataas, and they knew about that stuff. And they'd been to or was going to the clubs in the city, Latin Quarter, Union Square, the Red Parrot, all these legendary spots that you would go to and see live performances by Run DMC for the first time, Public Enemy for the first time. That older generation, they had a whole different outlook on the battle. They had a whole different outlook because it was Bronx. Bronx started hip hop. What's this guy talking about? He started hip hop. That was the argument. Or what's this guy talking about? Queensbridge started hip hop. So that was the argument. So to me, I'm like, damn, we got my neighborhood out of everybody got a beef with the Bronx about where hip hop started. That shit was crazy to me. So I'm like, damn, this is really ill. So, you know, KRS, we didn't know who he was. Everyone knows him now, but we was like, who is this guy? We really looked at it because Shan was one of my favorites. So it looked like Shan had this hand, easy, hand over fist. No, that's the wrong phrase for that. But landslide. Yeah. Landslide. He had this, right? Yeah. So when KRS, you know, went in, we said, wow, this dude is amazing. And who would have known at that point he would have turned to be one of the rap Mount Rushmore faces. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's like one of the greatest who ever did this. But back then, we was all in doubt. No one had heard of him. So it was exciting.
I guess a final one on Any Time to Tell. The last words on the song and then obviously on the album are Nas's rap should be locked in a cell. So why your raps, not you? And also returning to the cell metaphor.
Why my raps, not me? Well, it was the rap is guilty. Like, put it like this. It should be illegal that I'm allowed to talk like this. I can't even believe I got this free. This is what makes me understand the freedom of speech thing. It's like, wow, I didn't really get it. I mean, if somebody's yelling on a megaphone, you know, protest, you know, this place is, you have freedom of speech to say these things, right? That's one level. But now I'm saying the stuff I was saying wasn't ever said before in rap. So I was like, how am I getting away? I'm waiting any day they coming to get me from rap jail, rap prison. Somebody's coming, the Catholic Church, somebody, because I was saying things that wasn't said. So That's why I was like, Nas rap should be locked in a cell. Yeah, because shit is crazy.
You did have, you know, on the first two guest appearances where people heard about you, you know, Live at the Barbecue and the Back of the Grill, you had a lot of stuff that was really shocking on there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was just happy that America is a place where we can say what we got to say. A lot of people are scared to speak out on whatever the issue is. They're scared to say anything. You don't realize what your words can do. And that's what I realized while making that album.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
If there's a question from the crowd.
All right, I got a question for you really quick. I need a Rap Genius hat.
Oh,
yeah. No. You're good. You're good.
I have one.
You got one?
Yeah.
Who said that?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. I need that.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He calls him Master Syria, you know?
I got a two-part question. One is about the intro to Illmatic and, like, the inspiration behind that, like, offsetting the album. And, like, whatever, if you just EP'd it or whatever, who put the track list, you know, together and how y'all arranged that track list?
So you saying, like, the intro again?
Yeah, the intro inspiration and the entire track list inspiration.
Well, again, it was, you know, Wild Style Movie was really the first rap movie. So to me, I felt like there would never be, thank God for Fab Five Freddy and the rest of them, because I think his name is Charles Aon, who produced the movie Wild Style. Thanks to them, because they gave us a film that recorded the earliest stages of this thing. And without this thing, this movie, we would not be able to see what the club looked like, what being a rap star like Busy B in the movie. I don't know if you've seen it. He goes to a motel after the show, writes his name with dollar bills on the bed. Like, that was balling. You know what I mean? And it was for back then. Or the shotgun scene outside when they're about to get jacked. Those were real dudes outside with their gun that they filmed. He said, A to the K? A to the motherfucking K. That was their lingo. There was no script. That was their gun, and they were really outside robbing people. So they were able to put them in the movie. So you get the whole vibe of the city, especially the Bronx, that looked like a nuclear bomb had dropped off in there, you know? Landlords were setting their own buildings, and people were setting their own buildings on fire trying to get help. Like, this ain't no way to live. This, you know, you go through there, it looked like a battleground. So they recorded this shit. And that's why the film is so important, just in New York history. And so then Blondie's in the movie, you know what I'm saying? And she's like one of the first female rappers and shit. So I had to, it's too important. So I put that I took it off a VCR tape and I ran it through the console and we recorded it like that. So I did that part. And then I sampled, forget the name of the drum shit from the movie that me, AZ, and Jungle are talking about in the beginning, are talking over that in the beginning. I sampled that myself. And I didn't know what I was doing. I just had the engineer, you know, help me do it. And then we just sitting around with Hennessy and weed and everything else, and we just talking shit. And yeah, man, it was like, so as far as putting the album together, it was me. MC Search had brought me to Columbia. And he was, after then, he was like, yo, they want to sign you, man. Yo, would you mind if it went through my production company? Like, come on, let's get it. So we did the deal, and he was starting to be a producer, too. So he had beats for me. So I was writing to him, but I already had my idea in mind. My favorite groups at the time was Tribe Called Quest, Gangstar, of course, Lost Professor was my boy. So, and Pete Rock, CL Smooth and Pete Rock. So everybody's dream was to get a beat by Pete Rock. You didn't even think you could get a beat from Q-Tip. Like, all he does is Tribe, Busta a little bit here and there maybe, you know, the Native Tongue Crew, but you're not getting no Q-Tip beats. Forget it. That's a Tribe Called Quest. Don't even ask them. Don't even play yourself, right? So Pete Rock, he was doing more beats. He was doing more beats for other acts. But everybody was self-produced. Lenore ID tells me I fucked the game up because my album's the first one, a new guy with multiple hit producers that had never been done in rap. So you had, you know, Bomb Squad for Public Enemy. You had Pete Rock for CL Smooth and Q-Tip for A Tribe Called Quest. Dre for N.W.A. They were self-contained. They were self-produced. You know, so I came in the game like, yo, I need beats from all y'all niggas. And I was lucky enough. I was lucky enough that they wanted to do it. And, you know, I took a shot in the dark. But I had a way in, too, because Large Professor was friends with all of them. So he brought me in, and they were all mutual friends. So he made the introductions for me to Q-Tip, to Premier, to Pete Rock.
So that helped you put the track list together?
No. I did all of that. Right. I did all that. When I was done, though, Premier helped me. I didn't know anything about mastering. So I was just, all right, I'm supposed to show up at mastering. I don't know what that is. I had an idea, but so Premier said, don't worry, I'll come through. So Premier got there before me and started the mastering. I got there, I'm hanging out with him all day watching this process. And he had all the patience in the world to master. He believed in it that much where he mastered the entire album for me. But yeah, I sequenced it and all of that. Yeah.
In the album, you were dealing with a lot of battles, I want to say, in my mind. You were dealing with the street battle, and then you were also dealing with the metaphysical battle, and you were dealing with the spiritual battle. And I wanted to kind of know, how did you decide which one was the one to, like, keep in the forefront? Like, I personally want to know that, because as a MC, I want to know, like, I battle with, like, trying to keep spirituality and, you know, the street always having that.
If you put spirituality at the front of everything you're doing, you're going to be the spiritual MC. If you put crime or a street life in the front of all you're doing, you have to be careful to balance that, or you come off as just the street dude, female. So it's important that they can't title you. It's important that, because you want to someday do a street record. Next day you might want to touch the spiritual side. You might want to touch the other side. So you don't want them to say, why are you doing records like this? Because that's what they would do to me. If I made, say, a Uchi Wally or this, they go, oh my God, dude. Like, I walked in a club one day and I had a blunt. This is what this was 10, 12 years ago. And I heard these girls saying, oh man, he just messed it up for me. He smoked weed. Yeah, I would have. Yo, they were like, I heard them talking about how mad they was that I smoked weed. I'm like, I rapped about it back then. Back then, I rapped about it all the time. So I'm like, so they saw something for me probably from a song where I came off as more positive, you know, but. So they started to trap me and trying to trap me in those things, you know what I'm saying? So. Just keep it broad. Keep it broad, and it has to be balanced. Because a human being has a lot going to him than just one thing. I really personally don't like too many people that only are one thing. Because then they really blind. They're not really taking advantage of the rest of the shit out here. You just focus in on one thing. It's like, it's a lot to experience out here. Hip hop.
Hip hop got a question.
How did you being around Rakim in the studio, and is it true that you did some of your demos during Rakim studio time?
Yes. When he told me he liked what I was doing, he told me he works with Eric B and Rakim and Coogee Rap. And I was like, how did he say that so calm? Yo, it wasn't like today where there's like 20 amazing motherfuckers. It was like Coogee Rap and Rakim was those other heads on the rap Mount Rushmore. You know what I'm saying? Where there's only, what, four, five?
Four.
So that's them. He worked with the two. So he just said it like nothing. And he's like, huh?
The three.
KRS-One, yeah.
The three.
I'm not there. I'm not worthy. No, it's...
I think he's a solid opinion, right?
All right, well, anyway, he brought me to the studio, and he really was working. I didn't really see Rakim. I saw Eric B. Eric B was the producer of Eric B and Rakim and Coogee Rap. So, you know, him and Large got together and he got Large to, you know, to work with him, and Large just started lacing all that shit. And so I would see Eric B all the time. And that was cool to see because the studio was right near from where my neighborhood was, Power Play Studios. Right. I thought this place, I didn't even care to think where it was. I just knew Power Play Studios is where all of these records were being made. I did not realize it was walking distance kind of from my neighborhood. So when I got there and I seen, I'm like, it was this close all along? Like, it was amazing because I would hear stories about the you know, certain rap groups getting robbed coming in. I'm like, yo, it's like that? Like, really? And I'd hear the names of dudes that were heavy in the streets and then meet them in those studio sessions with Eric B. And, you know, so Eric just said, go ahead, work, because Rakim wasn't showing up. So, go ahead, work. Anytime you're ready, he told Lars Presley, let him work. Let him work, let him work. So I was working on an album back then. I cut about 7-8 records that probably Eric B has. I was 16. Right. And, yeah, so.
No,
these were songs called Artist and Assassin. This was called 550 Fahrenheit. Another one called something about female, something. I had a few records. I had a few records, yeah. These were not Illmatic records either.
The archives.
Yeah, these were like some other shit. And I met KRS-One there. And I'm like, oh. Actually, no, I didn't meet him. I saw him there. Mm-hmm. And to me, he epitomized gangster. He's on the front cover of the album cover with the guns and grenades and Criminal Minded. This is the Bronx, Criminal Minded, one of the best hip-hop albums ever made. And when I heard him talking, he had a proper way of speaking to this white family that was there. He was talking to his kids, and I was like, wow, that's like hip-hop etiquette. Like, I'm watching, and I never thought he would talk like that. I just thought he's a murderer. You know what I'm saying? Like, this dude was sounding really, really smart. So it's like, wow. I was like, I learned from that. I didn't meet him that day, but I learned from that, like, this dude is not but you remember Scott LaRock got killed, his DJ, his producer. So I was just happy to see him still making it happen. Yeah.
He got
one. He's not.
All right. I wanted to ask, when you were young, coming out of your city, I know it was different artists from different boroughs. I want to know what inspired you to stay yourself, go with your sound, who you are, and, you know, just keep pushing and doing, not even worry about all the other extra shit. You was just spitting your bars on the ground. I want to know what inspired you.
I guess if I want to do something, I want it to be right. You know, if I want to do something, do it right. Don't get ahead of it. Always say, hip-hop is bigger than you. I'm not bigger than hip-hop. Don't ever get that twisted. Right. So once you remember why you got into it in the first place, it's not really all about you. It's about this craft that you have and this thing that you love. It's all about, I think, fine-tuning. I think all of us fine-tune hip-hop. You know what I mean? Each album, each song is just our new way of trying to fine-tune it till we get it into perfection. But all of us stray. All of us stray at one time or another. You go this way, you go that way. It's like, and I saw some guys before me, when their style started to change, they started to get a little sexy on you. And you'd be like, you're like, yo, you know, and then I said, there's a way, you know, you could put on the GQ fly shit and be you and don't care what nobody say, but it got to really look like you don't give a fuck. But you can't become Aaron Hall.
Yeah. I know you were young, so you got all these other guys that's already young, and you look like, okay, I'm going to take this shit over.
That's how I looked at it. You have to have that feeling. You have to know that you're at that point where, but you worked at it that long that you got it to perfection, and your shit's going to take shit over. So as soon as I dropped, I said, I got him. And then Biggie came. Fuck my whole plan. I saw him coming, man. And when he got it together and they put out the Ready to Die, that changed everything because we weren't selling the records the West Coast was selling. So Biggie and Puff, I remember Puff saying, nigga, when you can have gunshots on your record, but when we done your gunshot, you're going to think that shit went off right in your ear, nigga. He's like the sound effects, you know, that shit you hear on NWA and all of that and all that. We're going to take it, and they did that. So that, to me, Ready to Die is our answer to the Chronic. It's an East Coast answer to the Chronic. So it was like saying, all right, Dre took it here, so anybody else drops an album, we have to be there. You know what I'm saying? So he did that. So that meant that now the rest of us had to go even higher. We were pushing ourselves to go higher. You know what I mean? So that's changed today. But yeah, Biggie changed the game. He was a game changer. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I got one for you. So, like, it's kind of off base of, like, this a little bit, but there was something you said when you were talking about, you know, if you're going to be a spiritual artist, you're going to be a spiritual artist, if you put that in front. You know, you're talking about how going outside gives you more, you know, avenues and lanes. So,
yeah.
Belly's one of my favorite movies, man.
Sure.
One of my favorite movies. So, how was, like, your work, you know, how were all your albums and your work up until that point, especially working with another artist like DMX, you know, in a movie? Because I feel like that title really helped break artists into the film industry. So, like, what was that like for you, that whole experience? And like, how did your work go with that?
Yeah, I think hype changed the game. You know, there was definitely, you know, artists doing movies before that, but he made it his, he played by his own rules. He did it his way, his cinema. The way he shot it to me is really amazing. How was it working with them, you say?
Yeah, like, how was it working with them and just, like, your works, like, before that? Like, how did that kind of open up into the film industry, you know what I mean?
Hype was so dope. Hype was doing our videos. So Hype saw us from a visual, he saw us from a different side. We were just showing up to just, you know, perform in front of the camera, shoot a great video. If you had a video by Hype Williams, you made it, right? That's how it was. So we go do our videos with Hype, and it was like your single was on steroids now. It was, you know, and so he saw it going even further. He saw it going into movies. And I'd hear him talking every while I got, saying, you guys could do movies. You guys could do movies. I hear him say that every once in a while, and one day he called me, and he's like, yo, let's go take a ride up to these mountains and shit and write this fucking movie. And he already wrote it, but he brought me in, you know, to rewrite. And working with DMX was amazing because he had just dropped Get At Me Dog. I had heard him on the mixtapes already, but he had dropped Get At Me Dog. And the character he had wrote, he described DMX to a T. Before we even thought about it, he described him to a T. So the character was already DMX. So when DMX Get At Me Dog came and Hype shot the video, he's like, yo, he came to me, yo, I got Tommy Buns. Who? DMX. I said, oh, shit, right? Yes, right? So working with X was ill because we bonded like brothers on the set. I didn't know what he was going to be like. I knew that he was changing rap, the rap game. I didn't know what he was going to be like personally. And dude was immediately, I said, this is one of the smartest dudes I ever met in my life, DMX. Like that fast, just from the way his mind works, the way he talks, what he talks about. So hype used to always be on me, though, on that movie. You know, Nas, man, you know, you got to really do more. We're going to have to take you out the movie. Yo, Nas, you're going to have to really tone it down a little bit. You know, the producers ain't really feeling it. Yo, Nas, you know, I that scene, you're not really doing it for everybody. He used to be on me bad, like pushing me. But he made me nervous as fuck because I'm like, I got the scene. The scene is easy. I know the scene in my sleep. But he's on me like a cheap suit. He's like, yo. Yo, dog, you really ain't making me believe you. No, no, no. But maybe because X was so good.
But I feel like you guys both complimenting each other, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I got a friend back home that's like crazy, like DMX, but, you know, we're good friends because, you know, because I'm the cool, calm, collective.
Right.
The, oh, I'm out of this world.
Right. Everybody knows somebody like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, let me bring
one thing
up. Because I spoke to you about it before. Like, just off the contrast of people's personalities. Remember I told you like how Busta was just talking about you and how y'all click. Like, people that don't know you, because we don't know you personally, it's like, you're more reserved. And then they're like, X, Busta, more rowdy.
Right.
Regular, how does that, is that the type of people that you met with on a regular, or is this, it's something about them personally that just drew you to their personalities? Like how X, you said he's most intelligent in the way he talked. What was it about like Busta?
X is a total street dude. He's brilliant. That dude is brilliant. You know, if you talk to him, you know, you'd be like, wow. Busta is such a good spirit. Busta's like a good, you know, that one of those guys that just brings that energy to you, like not hyper energy, but when he's talking to you, but just good everything. Like, he's encouraging. He talks to you like, and I see him do that with everybody. Everybody I've seen Busta deal with, you know, is never on no phony. He's always showing people love. I think that's one thing that stands out about him. He'll go on stage with you and take the microphone and tell the audience how much they should appreciate you. I see him do this for a lot of people because he loves the culture. And he's someone who stood the test of time, you know, so I take my hat off to Bus. So there's a lot you can talk to him about. He was in a group signed before I was, you know, putting out records, you know, so he's been in the game that long. So I like talking to people that's been in the game that long. I talk to Eric B, and he's, you know, he tell you about things that make you understand why things are the way they are now. So I love talking with everybody that got that wisdom.
Thanks, everyone.
Appreciate it.
That was our conversation with Nas about his classic debut album, Illmatic. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is created and written by Sean Sitaro.
Yeah, it worked. Anytime you were, you told Lars Presser, let him work.
This episode's co-host was Nicole Otero.
You're going to think that shit went off right in your ear.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I could not pop like this dude at all.
Our invaluable intern is Julia Hannafin.
This kid is nice.
Our music is by Psionic.
And when I heard him talking, he had a proper way of speaking to this white family that was there. He was talking to his kids, and I was like, wow, that's like hip-hop etiquette.
Special thanks to Jason Chandler for filming this great event.
That made him more of a legend to me, though.
If you liked what you heard on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, make sure to find us on iTunes. From there, you can subscribe so that you'll never miss an episode. Also, make sure to give us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the better chance we have of continuing to get great guests like Nas. Join us in 2 weeks when we have an epic conversation with Grand Mixer DXT. DXT is the first, and perhaps still the best, turntablist out there. You'll probably remember him from his turn on Herbie Hancock's Rocket. We'll see you then, outside the lines.
Okay, so